Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. For nearly a month, federal troops doused Portland protesters with CS tear gas, a chemical weapon banned in war. Now, its residues still cling to the trees and grass in Lounsdale Square and Chapin Park, and may be making its way into Portland's stormwater system. Yet no one really knows what chemicals have been used by law enforcement on Portland's protesters. Today, we talk with Damon Mott-Story, Healthy Climate Program Director for Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, about the potential impacts these toxic chemicals have left on our public health, our wildlife, and our air and water quality. Damon, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you so much, Barbara. It's a pleasure to be here again.
Well, it's kind of a pleasure also to have our city back under our own control, so to speak, as opposed to having the feds here. But it seems like there's some real lingering effects from that month of incessant tear gas. And I'm wondering, as a representative of Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, what is your take on the long-term impacts that we are experiencing from all the tear gas that was let loose downtown? And what do we have to do to go about actually finding out what those impacts are?
Yeah, so this issue of tear gas and its lingering impacts, its environmental impacts, and the full total impacts that it's had over the course of time that people have been protesting in Portland is an issue that I think is really great that we're digging into more. And if I could just sort of zoom out a little bit and kind of, you know, start with a little bit of the 30,000 foot view, I would love to do that. So, you know, I think, first of all, before the feds started acting up in Portland and started joining the Portland police in brutalizing protesters, we saw Portland Police Bureau acting very aggressive against nonviolent protesters all the way from the beginning of the protests on May 30th when George Floyd was killed, and all the way to the present, right? So this has been a persistent problem with our local police before, during, and after the federal police's involvement. So that's, I think, an important thing for a lot of folks to understand, especially in the national audience. You know, I like so many Portlanders, I've had friends and loved ones, relatives texting me saying, what the heck is going on with the federal law enforcement in Portland? And it's a good question. It was a very scary, very fascist thing to have happen to us, to have the federal law enforcement acting the way that they did unconstitutionally.
Or actually that they were even coming in.
Exactly.
Uninvited.
Yes. The fact that they were there at all is extremely concerning, and their actions were extremely concerning as well. But also so much of what they did, with the exception of, you know, abducting people into unmarked vans and not giving people arrest records, right? That was a little different. But with the exception of stuff like that, a lot of what the federal law enforcement were doing, and certainly with the use of different CS gases on protesters, is something that folks were already very familiar with. And I will also say I have been very familiar with that as well, too, over the course of many years. I remember back in 2017, I was a part of a nonviolent demonstration that was the night before the inauguration of Donald Trump, and the police were very aggressive and used chemical weapons on nonviolent protesters because we got close to wanting to cross the Burnside Bridge into East Portland, and that was it. You know, that was the only justification that was used for the police to deploy tear gas on a crowd of people that include folks in wheelchairs. You know, there were a lot of young people in the crowd and a lot of elderly folks in the crowd. And so this has been a years-long persistent problem with the Portland police. And I think it's also really important for us to remember that these protests are for Black Lives Matter. That is why people have been out in the streets for 70 days consecutively now. And it is the reason why these protests are disproportionately brutalized by law enforcement in a way that we don't see law enforcement responding to armed occupations of state capitals to protest mask mandates or stay home orders, right? Those, I think when you see the difference between the ways that Oregon law enforcement and federal law enforcement have been cracking down on Black Lives Matter protests versus people who are protesting masks and public health measures, it's a very different kind of a story. And I think that race plays a huge factor into that. And I think racism in our police force is something that it's really demonstrating itself in the ways that these things are happening.
I want to back up even further in time. I remember a time when the Portland police didn't use tear gas. And tear gas was something when I was young, I encountered much more on the East Coast. I went to a number of demonstrations in Washington, D.C. in the late 60s, early 70s, protesting the Vietnam War. And there was a massive amount of CS being sprayed everywhere. In Portland, back then, I don't remember there being any tear gas. And I'm not sure when the Portland police started using it, because I noticed in 2011 with the Occupy demonstrations, that's the first time I saw the militarization of the Portland police. And it was very, very unnerving. So how do you see that things have changed? And how recently do you think it is that the Portland police have been using tear gas to the extent that we're using it in the last few months?
It's a really good question, and I think that it's important to remember that the word that gets used to describe nonviolent protesters in Portland is terrorist, and that is the word. Well, and it's the word used by the Trump administration, right? It's used by very specific people, but it's used in a very specific way, and I think that that's connected to the so-called war on terror that began after the 2001 9/11 attacks. As a way to justify brutal, horrific crimes against humanity that happened throughout the Middle East and that are still happening in places like Guantanamo Bay, right? So the way that the U.S. military has justified their abuses against human beings throughout the world has been a playbook for the way that the local police departments across the United States have been operating, right? It sort of has set a precedent that local law enforcement have been able to pick up. And we've also seen since the Ferguson uprisings and Black Lives Matter movement has emerged that there is a direct connection between the kinds of military devices that we are sending to Israel, for example, that assist the Israeli military in brutalizing Palestinians are often the very same equipment and same tools and weapons that are being used against American people as well in these protests. And so I think that you can start to connect the dots between an increase in the U.S. military and military operations in the Middle East and this sort of an unending cycle of wars. To also the ways that we have been fueling crackdowns on civilians in other countries. And all of that is just, it has set the groundwork for the different local law enforcement bureaus across the United States to use the very same tactics and the very same playbooks that the US military has been using in those other places. And in many cases, the same equipment that the US military has been using gets just passed on to police departments and they get to just use it for free. So it's been this massive militarization of police forces that has been unfolding for over the course of many decades. So you would need to ask somebody who's more of an expert at tracking the Portland Police Bureau in specific to chart a course and a history of exactly when the Portland police were starting to use these devices. But I think it's important to kind of ground it in that larger context that we see this across the country as sort of a continuation of the militarization of our police forces.
Well, I'm going to have Joanne Hardesty on in a few weeks, so she may actually be able to give us a little more specifics about the history of the militarization of the Portland police. Another thing about CS gas, back the first time I ever was around it was in 1967 when I went to help levitate the Pentagon. And CS was being used, and it was a big deal that it was CS as opposed to, I think there was another tear gas at that time that my recollection was called CN, but it was not nearly as toxic as the CS gas. Actually, one of the things that I learned from an email I got from Earl Blumenauer, he said that CS gas is banned for military use because it's so toxic.
Under the Geneva Convention, yes, under the Geneva Convention, the use of tear gas in warfare is not allowed.
So I find it interesting that it's not allowed in warfare anymore, but it's allowed on the streets of the United States.
So Dr. Erica Moseson here in Oregon wrote a really great blog post about this that I think should be required reading for a lot of people. She's a pulmonologist and is considered a real expert on respiratory health in Oregon. And she wrote this really great blog post really calling into question this terminology that the police use really frequently of non-lethal or less lethal weaponry that gets used on peaceful protests. And one of the things that she cites in that blog post is studies done by the US military on CS gas that showed that in healthy military recruits who are generally, young and don't have other sort of existing respiratory issues, when they were exposed to CS gas, it more than doubled the rate of pneumonia, bronchitis, and viral illness following exposure. Things where people die from those diseases every day. And with 1 in 10 Oregonians suffering from asthma, that's really a big concern, even if there wasn't also the COVID-19 pandemic happening on top of all of this, which I think makes all of this especially more heinous, right? And so I think those are some of the main red flags around CS gas. But we've also been seeing some really disturbing reports from frequent protesters and journalists who've been covering the protests really consistently, that not only are people experiencing some really weird symptoms, a lot of people who menstruate have been experiencing very strange disruptions to their menstrual cycles, and a lot of people are reporting that there have been different substances that have been used. Sometimes people have been sort of like, oh, something is different tonight. There's like a very different kind of a quality to the tear gas that's being used on this night versus that night. So there's a lot that we do not know about the specific chemical makeup of what's been being sprayed in people's lungs. And we really deserve to have more information and more data on exactly what was being used by different police forces. And what the impacts of those chemicals are, because what we do know about sort of the most commonly used O-chlorobenzylidine, I'm not good at saying the names of it, but is that it does have these impacts on increasing respiratory illnesses after exposure. So we do know that, and there's a whole lot more that we don't know, and there's a lot of good research being done. Now that that will help us to understand better what the impacts have been, but we have a lot of open questions that haven't been filled.
The thing you were trying to pronounce just now, was that the long term for CS, or is there other equally noxious materials being used that you're concerned about?
Right. Dr. Moseson says that tear gas is a name for a collection of compounds that are designed to induce pain through severe irritant means, whether in the eyes, skin, or lung. And so, yeah, O-chlorobenzylidine, I think I did a better job that time, is one of the chemicals in that compound. And so that's what we're talking about when we talk about CS gas or tear gas.
I think that there's other kinds of tear gas as well, though. I'm not, lately we've just been hearing about CS. I mean, as I was saying earlier, when I was younger, it seemed like there were varieties of which CS was the worst one. So I'm wondering what happened. Anybody know what happened to the other ones that were not quite as malignant as CS gas?
Yeah, that's a good question. And like I said earlier, there were some folks starting to recognize some subtle differences between what was being sprayed on one night versus another night, so that's another question, is we don't necessarily know in all cases what exactly was being sprayed and when. And I know that there have been some health professionals and medics on the ground that have done some really great work on trying to pick up canisters and collect canisters from tear gas deployments so that we can better understand and hopefully track and trace what exactly was used on what given night. So I think it's my hope, it's my fervent hope that in the coming weeks and months and years, we'll have a much clearer picture of exactly what was deployed and when, so that we can understand the environmental and public health impacts.
Well, I also was reading in the Oregonian that one of the questions was how many of the tear gas canisters that were deployed had expired, and that in fact that might make the CS gas more noxious than if it hadn't been expired.
Yeah, that's an important question that should be folded into it as well. Is what is the impact of using stuff that has been expired, right? Because usually there's a really good reason why you stop using something once it's reached its expiration date. And so that's an important question to ask as well.
Interestingly, I was down at the protests 2 weekends ago with a friend, and we were standing in Lansdowne Square, and she said, "It smells like marijuana." I said, no, that's tear gas. But I was thinking as I was smelling it, I don't remember tear gas smelling like marijuana. And it was also from the night before because they hadn't started gassing when we were there.
A lot of people talk about it sort of like there's sort of a peppery, sort of a spicy sort of undertone that sometimes a lot of people, especially when they're on the far edges or the outskirts of tear gas deployment, like that's usually the first one of the first warning signs is that the air kind of smells a little spicy. That's a good indicator that you're approaching a cloud of tear gas. But it's, oh my God, it is so miserable. If anybody who has experienced a really concentrated dose of this stuff knows just how harmful it is. Another thing that people don't talk about enough, I think, is just how much it contributes to the risk of COVID spread to be exposed to this in the moment that people are exposed to it. So the Portland police likes to shrug it off and say, well, if you don't like being exposed to tear gas, just move out of the way of the tear gas. Well, that's problematic for a number of reasons. Oftentimes, the police give confusing and contradictory information as to which direction they want protesters to move in. So that's not always clear or easy for people to do. In some cases, people end up getting trapped between different lines of police officers and sort of kettled in with a big cloud of tear gas. And so, you know, that's why people started bringing leaf blowers and respirators to try to keep themselves safe. Because what happens when you are exposed to this stuff is you start coughing, and oftentimes people then need to pull their masks down so that they can clear the stuff out of their system. And then you've got people coming into close contact with each other to flush each other's eyes out and be safe. All of that means that when you're coughing more, you're more likely to be expelling viral particles into the atmosphere, into the air around you, which means that other people are likely to breathe those viral particles. Whereas if you've got peaceful protesters who are physically distancing and wearing masks, then the chances of COVID spread at protests is a lot lower. But when you've got people coughing in clouds of tear gas, that is going to highly increase the risk of exposure between protesters of COVID-19. Even more so when we see that police are sometimes not wearing masks as they're arresting people, for example.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Damon Mott-Story, who's the Healthy Climate Program Director for Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, about the environmental impacts from all that tear gassing and other so-called less-than-lethal weapons used by federal troops on Portland protesters this past month. One of the things that really struck me when I was down there a week and a half ago now was that I was still feeling and smelling the tear gas. This is like 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock on Saturday night. The last that they had tear gas was probably at about 2 o'clock that morning. So it had been, I don't know, 18 hours since the last tear gassing. I was surprised that it was still so present. And this is, of course, after about 3 weeks of incessant tear gassing. And I guess this is another thing we should maybe talk about. Did the feds use more tear gas than the Portland police did in the first part of the protests before the feds came in?
You'd need to talk to somebody who is more scrupulous in documenting exactly what was being deployed and when. And I know that people are collecting that data, so I don't have that close at hand with me, so I can't really answer that question. What I do know is that both the Portland police and the federal law enforcement were both using copious amounts of this stuff. And Mayor Wheeler liked to brag that the amount of Portland police deployment of tear gas in July was not super high. But that's because they didn't need to be. If the federal law enforcement were using tear gas, then the Portland police didn't have to be deploying it themselves. And so that's a really insidious dodge of accountability right there, because in the month of June and now here in August, as the protests continue, the Portland police have shown that they are quite willing to use whatever loopholes they can from lawsuits and state laws to be able to declare a riot and deploy tear gas when they feel like breaking up the protest, even if there isn't a riot actually happening, right? Even if people are just standing and exercising their First Amendment rights. Police have found a way to get around the accountability structures that lawsuits and state laws, you know, initiated by community members have been trying to use to hold them accountable. They find ways to get around that.
I found it kind of curious. I recall that the state banned the use of tear gas and less than, quote, less than lethal weapons against protesters sometime at the end of June. And there were some loopholes that had to do with if they declared a riot, but it was still pretty clearly that this was being frowned on. And then shortly after that, I think the Portland City Council also banned the use of tear gas by the Portland police. So one of the ways they got around it was that every night they declared it was a riot, whether or not it was. But I found it a little bit even more disconcerting that Wheeler claimed that the police had only used tear gas twice in the month of July after the feds came. And that, to me, is an example of how he was aware that they were already violating the ban that the Portland City Council had imposed on the police.
Well, yeah, and those bans all had loopholes, right? You know, the issue is that we don't have an outright ban on the use of tear gas right now because the Portland police can still use it if they feel that their lives are in danger. The problem is that who gets to decide whether or not the Portland police feel threatened? The Portland police get to decide that in the moment. And so, given the track record of Portland police and other police departments across the country being willing to lie and fabricate stories and twist around the facts and the realities of different situations to suit their own PR benefit, that really is very concerning because we are giving them sort of a blank check to be able to say, we felt that, like, there was a riot, and oh, we felt like our lives were threatened as police officers in full head-to-toe protective riot gear. You know, it's a little hard to believe that a few stray water bottles or empty cans being thrown over a fence is really life-threatening to somebody in so much body armor, right? And so these are the kinds of things that get used to sort of subterfuge and make construct a narrative that that makes people more sympathetic to the police. But and it's interesting too to think about how Mayor Wheeler actually was benefiting from the federal law enforcement coming to town, despite all of his protests and despite all of his tweets and statements saying that he wanted the feds to go home. It actually really benefited his political agenda because it helped to take the focus off of his police that he does have control over. And it allowed him to do things like say, oh, look, we only gassed people twice in the month of July when, you know, the impact is still the same. Protesters are getting gassed regardless of where it's coming from. And Ted Wheeler himself went out to speak with protesters and was gassed by federal law enforcement and said that it was a really unpleasant experience. And yet he still will not do an outright tear gas ban. There are still these loopholes around which the Portland police can continue to use it.
Interestingly, now that the feds are gone from Portland, I understand that the protesters are focusing again on the Portland police, and there's been protests at the police headquarters in Southeast Portland and also the Multnomah County Sheriff's. What's your sense of what's going on there? I understand that the police have declared a riot at least one of those nights when protesters were out on Burnside.
Right. So whenever we hear police declared a riot, we should always be having our critical listening skills on as Portlanders. We should always be thinking, does that mean a riot was actually occurring, or did it just mean that the police wanted people to leave a certain area? And it seems like more often than not these days, the latter is more true. It's also important to remember that the Portland protests never stopped being about local police. It may have been a new sort of surge of activity and new people coming out to join the protests when the federal law enforcement started getting involved and people started worrying about the sort of attack on civil liberties that that represented. But the protests have always been about Portland police brutality. And there have been a lot of times when it's been a little bit obfuscated that the reason people are out here is because Portland police have been just as bad as the Minneapolis Police Department and the Louisville Police Department and all of these other, you know, police departments that have been sort of thrown under the spotlight after the murders of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery and so many others. We still don't have justice for Quanice Hayes here in Portland, or Patrick Kimmons, or many of the black trans women that have been murdered in Portland. And so the problem with saying that we were wanting just the feds out of Portland is that then starts to detract a little bit from the reason that we've been out there night after night after night for 70 nights, which is that all police have been racist and brutalizing black people, indigenous people, other people of color. And, you know, when white people start to also show up for the Movement for Black Lives, they get subjected to some of the same kinds of police brutality, but in different ways, right? It's important to remember that brutality against black, indigenous, and people of color is very different than brutality against white protesters.
However, I've heard some interesting comments, both from black people and white people, that this has been perhaps the first time on such a scale that white people are beginning to experience even just a taste of what black people go through with the cops. And the Oregonian did an interesting photo essay of a lot of injuries of that people receive from the cops and from the feds, mainly from the feds, in the protests. And I don't recall that I saw any black people in those injuries, but I did see a photograph of Tripp Jennings, who's a videographer for the movement, who was hit with a projectile in his eye. It actually smashed through the goggles that he was wearing and created and lacerated his eye. And it was just an indication of the, really, some of the intensity of some of these injuries that people experience. I wonder what your thoughts are about how this might have perhaps created a little bit more of a leveling effect between white protesters who are out who are protesting violence against black people, police violence against black people, and the black community who's been experiencing this violence for many, many, many decades, if not many centuries, in fact.
Yeah, so I think it is absolutely impossible to level out and equalize the brutality that people of color experience in this country versus the brutality that white protesters are experiencing from Portland police and federal law enforcement. It's definitely heinous and egregious and horrible. I've seen the images of the 26-year-old who was shot in the face with a rubber bullet at close range just for holding up a boombox. There were several members of the Wall of Moms that were had to be taken to the emergency room for impacts to the face. And those are all really horrific and terrible and need to be uplifted and documented. But it also needs to be understood as a wholly separate category from the violence that black and indigenous and other people of color have experienced from the police, especially black people. And it's important to note that white people, we have the privilege of being able to go home and have the brutality end there. By not being out at the protests, we can then sort of go back to our white privilege safety bubble. And that is not a choice that black people can make in this country. And so I think that is a really important distinction that I hope that white folks will really internalize, that this still pales in comparison to the brutal legacy and ongoing racism and brutality that black people are experiencing. And that is why these protests are happening. It's such a simple phrase, Black Lives Matter, and yet the reason we have to be saying it is because our country is not operating as though Black Lives Matter. And so I think it is important for white folks to go to the protests and literally put our bodies on the front lines so that it helps to provide safety for black folks that are protesting and other people of color that are protesting, but it is in no way comparable to the type of brutality that black and other people of color have been experiencing. And so I think that's an important distinction, but I think the point does stand that it is a moment for building empathy, right? I think the primary reason why we should be out in the streets protesting is so that we can demand change and demand racial justice. But if there's a little bit of empathy that comes along the way as people are doing that, that I think is important. But I think it's important also to not conflate and mix up the experiences of experiencing brutality as a white person at protests with the experience of not being able to escape the racist brutality that people of color experience in our country.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Damon Mott Story, Healthy Climate Program Director for Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility. And we're talking about the environmental impacts that all that tear gassing and other so-called less than lethal weapons used by federal troops on Portland protesters this month. But we're also talking about the general practices of the Portland police over many, many years that are not that different in many ways from the federal troops that were being protested against. I'm curious, Damon, I mean, before all this started, we would be talking about environmental issues and health issues when we talk. And I remember actually things shifting with you back right after George Floyd was murdered, where we were talking about doing a program about Jordan Cove LNG, and you were concerned about people's focus being really on the protests now and not on things like LNG export terminals and methanol refineries. I'm wondering, how has your focus shifted, and how does your focus now, dealing so much with the protests that have been going on, also relate back to the environmental issues that you've been dealing with for a number of years?
Oh, it's all so interconnected and so deeply interwoven together. And to be clear, I have never bemoaned the focus on Black Lives Matter. I think it's first and foremost vitally important to recognize that racial justice is climate justice. And we cannot have climate justice without racial justice. And so the work of showing up for the movement for Black Lives and declaring that Black Lives Matter and that we need racial justice is climate activism. I truly believe that. And I can kind of break it down and sort of, spell out some of those connections, because to be able to talk about the environmental impacts of tear gas without first regrounding ourselves in why we ought to care about the environment is missing an important connection. And I think that that's rooted in the way that many of us have been taught from a very early age about what environmentalism is. I certainly was fed the message that environmentalism is about caring for the planet and caring for nature and the natural world. We see this in terms like conservation, conservationists, and there's a lot of very specific imagery that comes up when we think about environmentalism in this way. We think about leave no trace and keep America beautiful. When you're out in national parks, making sure that you don't litter and keep the trail clean, right? That's a lot of the kind of imagery that we think about. But the reason that I work on these issues now is because I've now come to understand that it is about our health and it is about our connection to the environment and the fact that our human inextricable connection to the natural world means that when we don't have a healthy environment, we ourselves cannot be healthy. And so by focusing on just litter and trash on the side of the road as sort of issues that we need to focus on for environmentalism, we're leaving out actually also the very vital impacts that that have pollution has on people's health, right? And so I think when we think about sort of some of the indirect impacts that tear gas may be having on the environment, that could be getting into our storm drains and into the river. It could be adding to the already very polluted Portland Harbor site, the last 11 miles of the Willamette River that are already so heavily polluted that there's big concerns around the ways that that impacts people who rely on the fish from the Willamette River. The Portland Harbor Community Coalition's doing really vital work to advocate for equitable cleanup of that Superfund site and ensure that benefits go to the communities that have depended on the fish from the river. So these are the examples of the background issues, the context upon which this tear gas and police brutality has been happening, right? So I believe very much that it's all deeply interconnected, especially when we look at the health outcomes of people who live in places like so-called Cancer Alley in Louisiana near very many oil refineries. We also see this here too in Oregon along major highways. We see worse health outcomes because of diesel pollution. There are different parts of Oregon that are right along oil train tracks, right, where there's the impact of diesel pollution from those trains, but also the threat of an oil train derailment and explosion, right? So these are the kinds of environmental injustices, and because so often we end up major corporations end up putting these polluting facilities into the backyards of communities of color, it means that this is really environmental racism, right? And all of this connects back to the COVID-19 pandemic and the movement for Black Lives, because it is these background environmental contaminations that are part of the reason why so many more Black and Latinx and Pacific Islander communities are dying from COVID-19, more so than communities who've had the privilege of living in areas with cleaner air and cleaner water. So these issues are also fundamentally inextricably linked. That, the health of our environment means the health of our people, right? And the health of our people is essential to racial justice. It really is about being able to live, survive, and thrive, no matter who you are, no matter what the color of your skin. And we have so deeply entrenched a system of environmental racism that has caused that to not be possible for people through no fault of their own.
Well, I've heard just the other day a pronouncement that racism is a public health issue. In fact, it's a public health crisis. Are you familiar with that at all?
So there's a number of different medical associations that are working on this particular issue, and actually Leslie Gregory here in Oregon has been a staunch advocate for declaring racism as a public health crisis, and she's working hard to try to get the National Institutes of Health to acknowledge this. The American Medical Association is one of the groups that has already acknowledged that racism is a public health crisis, and it's true. You know, I think when we look at how the reasons underpinning the different racist outcomes of COVID-19 deaths are coming because people are not being set up to succeed for their health based on their race, right? So we see way more food deserts existing in Black and Indigenous and other people of color communities. We see so much more environmental pollution in communities of color. And all of those lead to the kinds of underlying pre-existing conditions that mean that people are less able to fight off respiratory illnesses like COVID-19. And not only that, but there was also an op-ed written by a number of Multnomah County health advisors, including Dr. Ryan Pettaway, in the Oregonian, that was talking about how triage plans for COVID-19 are largely based in Oregon on whether or not somebody has pre-existing conditions, and that people without pre-existing conditions are like deemed more likely to survive and therefore more deserving of resources in some triage scenarios. And that itself is a racist thing, because those pre-existing conditions are often more prevalent in communities of color through no fault of their own, but through different racist policies that have meant that they don't have access to the kinds of things that that lead to greater social determinants of health.
I wanted to talk about this huge accumulation of toxins that's been a result of the police response to the protests over the last few months. I was hearing that there's tear gas lingering downtown in the trees, in the grass, in the vegetation. Probably, I would imagine it's lingering in windowsills and all kinds of places. And I'm also wondering, I can't remember any other time in my period in Portland where there's been so much tear gas used that it's lingered this long. Is this a new phenomenon?
Yeah, you know, that's a really good question. I, for one, have not seen sustained use of this substance for such a long period of time. I think that that's deeply concerning, and I know that a lot of people are studying and trying to gather more information about what's going on. I think folks should look at Neighbors for Clean Air as well as some of the other groups that are happening, because they're starting to call for an outright ban on tear gas because of the concerns that they have around some of the issues. They cite that there have been many anecdotal accounts of gynecological disruptions, as I said, persistent nausea, ongoing headaches, they are compiling reports to submit to the Multnomah County Department of Health. So if you go online to Neighbors for Clean Air, that is whatsinourair.org, then you can go and take their survey to let them know, you know, help them to compile data on what is going on. They are also encouraging people to contact the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality to make a complaint. You can call 888-997-7888 or go online to the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality website in order to file an environmental complaint. So that's some of the work that's being done there.
And Damon, if you can send me those links, then I'll put
For
them on
sure.
our website later on.
And there's a really great group of doctors and medical students from OHSU who've also been showing up for Black Lives at the protests, who have also been documenting some things as well. So the good news is there are some people trying to figure this out, piece it together, but we all got to help them out by getting them the data that they need.
Now, Bill Blumenauer sent out an email a few days ago where he basically said he was calling on several state agencies to start looking into this. Are you familiar with what he's doing? And has your group been talking with him at all?
Oh, we love our working relationship with Congressman Blumenauer. You know, he's so responsive to a lot of the things that the community are raising concerns about. And yeah, so he I loved that he did a town hall with Commissioner Hardisty and with Representative Ayanna Pressley recently, and that helped to elevate some of the issues going on. Yeah, I'm not closely acquainted with the work that Earl Blumenauer is doing, but I'm glad that he's you know, really trying to find creative ways to use, you know, whatever powers we have to be able to find accountability here.
Well, I wanted to talk just a little bit more about what's on the ground and maybe in the air right now and the concerns about it going to stormwater. So let's talk a little bit about the path that the tear gas would take from the time it's been sprayed on protesters to where it might wind up into the Willamette River.
Yeah, so just like any other thing that gets kicked up and thrown into the environment, either rain comes or, we've seen the federal law enforcement actually using power washers to spray off the sidewalks and surfaces on streets. And so that all goes into stormwater drains and, stormwater then, gets discharged. And so, I think that we should be thinking about the Portland Bureau of Environmental Services as another agency to be thinking of in terms of helping to understand exactly how is this getting into our environment, and what are the key questions that we need to be asking. And I think the health of the Willamette River is really a big concern, especially since a lot of this has been happening in downtown Portland. Another thing we haven't mentioned also that is more air contaminant related is that there are a lot of people that live in downtown, people that live in apartments or condos, but also people who live unhoused on the streets. And this is impacting their health too. In many, this is their home. And so there's no really getting away from all of this lingering tear gas residue. And so I think we need to be thinking about what does that chronic exposure look like in addition to people having repeated acute exposures at protests night after night. I think both are probably going to result in being very harmful, but in potentially different ways.
Well, another thing that struck me as I was reading about how the prisoners in the Justice Center, they're on the other side of, I guess they're on Second, a block away from where all the height of the tear gassing was going on. They were also actually getting tear gassed inside their cells. And I wanted to talk a bit about that. I mean, that's another case of incredible inequity.
Absolutely. So people who are prisoners in the Multnomah County Justice Center are absolutely held hostage to this exposure. And the reports that we've been getting is that people who, even if you close your windows, this stuff is still getting into the rooms of buildings nearby where it is deployed. And they have no choice around that. They have no agency in the matter. And for anybody that wants to blame the protesters for that, it is a choice that the police and federal law enforcement use tear gas on these protests that are largely very peaceful, largely nonviolent. And so the responsibility lies squarely on the people who deployed the tear gas for the impacts that it has on those inmates. It reminds me also of the present ongoing crisis that we are experiencing in Oregon state prisons. Both the state penitentiary in Salem and the Eastern Oregon Correctional Institution have over 100 documented cases of COVID-19. And Governor Kate Brown has only commuted the sentences of 57 state inmates, even though lawmakers believe that about 2,000 could just be qualified for compassionate early release in order to protect public health. And so, yeah, I think that much more attention needs to be going to people who are in the criminal, so-called criminal justice system that is incarcerating so many people, disproportionately people of color.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on Cebu Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LP FM and KODX LP FM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Damon Mott-Story, Healthy Climate Program Director for Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, about the environmental impacts from all that tear gassing and other so-called less than lethal weapons that were used by federal troops on Portland protesters this month. Well, in the last part of the show, actually, I want to move over to Lebanon. This has kind of just jumped into my head as we're thinking about all these kind of toxins and dangers that we are faced. And I can't help but think about the connection between this really horrific explosion in the port of Beirut yesterday.
Which we believe was due to ammonium nitrate, a very volatile, chemical.
And it made me think immediately, actually, when I was reading about that yesterday, about the port of Tacoma and also the port of Portland and how close we are to those kinds of disasters. One thing that's interesting, the first report I heard about the explosion in Beirut, when I heard it was the port, they were talking about it being a terrorist attack. They were talking about maybe the Israelis had targeted Hezbollah. And I heard it was at the port, and I thought, I bet something blew up. And then the next thing we hear, it's about ammonium nitrate. What does this make you think about the lessons that we should be taking to heart right now about the kinds of facilities that we have that maybe are not in much safer storage protection than what was going on in the port of Beirut?
Yeah, I think that the lesson that we should be gleaning from that is that we need to know what kinds of volatile chemicals are in our environment. And that includes the kinds of chemicals that are being stored in large tanks in places like the Critical Energy Infrastructure Hub in Northwest Portland, which is also where the Zenith Energy facility is that transloads crude oil. from trains that come through the Columbia River Gorge. So we need to know what kinds of substances are being stored in different places like that and what the risks are to communities living nearby them. And there's a lot of reason to believe that a lot of folks are living in the so-called blast zone from oil train threat of oil train derailments and explosions. But also, what if there's, the big earthquake and a lot of the tanks in the Northwest Industrial District of Portland are compromised? A lot of the facilities out there really are in great need of being updated. And we just don't have a clear enough picture of exactly what are all the risks of all of the different things that are being stored there. And many companies, this is especially rampant in the fracking industry. Many companies hide behind these proprietary shields that shield them from having to disclose exactly what chemicals are being stored in what places, because it's, proprietary trade secret information. But the problem is that that means our public health departments are woefully underprepared for understanding what are the risks to health and safety that come from the different chemicals being stored at facilities like this. So I think that's one of the lessons that we should be really gleaning from the horrible, horrible explosion that happened in Lebanon.
Well, I was looking at a reading about the blast zone in Beirut and how far out the explosion resonated. And I guess windows were blown out for several kilometers. I mean, it sounded like a few miles. And it reminded me of the blast zone maps that I've seen for Tacoma LNG. And that now they're saying it's, I guess, the incineration zone is within a mile. And then it's 3 miles out for major, major damage. And then now they're saying it's like even 10 miles out. So it seemed that with the ammonium nitrate explosion, that it's a pattern, probably not quite as bad as LNG, but it was sort of an indication of what we could expect. What kind of red flags are raised when you see something like that and think about what people have already been talking about for so long in this community about our concerns about these very dangerous, volatile materials that are being stored?
I think we need to take it as inspiration to fight even harder and work even more deeply to ensure that things like the Jordan Cove LNG export terminal are never built in Southern Oregon, right? And we need to stop the Tacoma LNG facility in Tacoma because the risk is just too great that something could happen and we would have just, a tragic, horrific amount of loss that comes with a major sort of worst case scenario explosion. I actually kind of am reminded of the nuclear power industry, frankly, because we are often told that new nuclear reactors are going to be much safer than Chernobyl or Fukushima. But the fact of the matter is, if you even have a tiny chance that a facility could explode or melt down in such a way that it creates just lasting, irreparable harm to the communities around it, we shouldn't be having that in our community, right? And I think that there's an important public health principle known as the precautionary principle that holds that if you don't fully understand exactly what risks are being taken, you can't really, make an informed decision on whether or not you are accepting that risk, in a way that is acceptable. And so when we don't know fully, what the all of the different myriad risks would be with a massive facility like Tacoma LNG, Jordan Cove LNG, and even if we know that there is a tiny chance that there could be a big explosion that harms a lot of people, that's a good enough indicator that we need to be looking for better alternatives to those sorts of facilities. And the good news is that those alternatives do exist. We don't need the Tacoma LNG facility. We don't need the Jordan Cove LNG export terminal. That's something that would be exporting, Canadian and Rocky Mountain gas to foreign markets, right? This is not something that benefits our communities. We don't need these massive fossil fuel projects that harm our health and safety, and threaten us with explosions. We can choose better alternatives.
I was just thinking of another slight irony right now that's going on around the COVID and the methanol refinery that's being proposed for Calama, and how Northwest Innovation Works, who wants to build that methanol refinery, has been talking about how methanol is basically it's part of nature. They call it wood alcohol. It's used, you know, it's very, very safe and it's not poisonous. And now it's come out that methanol has been used in some of the hand sanitizers. And so there's a lot of talk about how you just put methanol on your skin and it can cause really toxic reactions. And if you drink methanol, you'll die immediately. So I just wonder if this helps to raise some of the issues that opponents of the methanol refinery have been raising all along, that methanol is not a safe substance and it's not something that belongs in a community like Kalama, or it should be even made for that matter.
Yeah, I think those are all really good points. And I think it helps us to remember that a facility like the Kalama Fracked Gas to Methanol Refinery in Southwest Washington just comes with an unbelievably huge list of risks that are not worth it to the community. And, you know, I'll also add that, like, there are going to need to be pipelines and routes to get fracked gas into the Kalama Methanol Refinery if it were ever built. And that those transmission lines also come with carrying risks as well. So all of it is something that needs to be looked at. And the most important thing is we deserve to know what all the risks are from these major facilities. And we need to know what kinds of chemicals are being stored in different parts of our cities.
So now, Damon, in the weeks ahead, as you are, I guess, continuing with your bifurcated life right now, protesting and also continuing to work to prevent climate change and to deal with public health issues. How do you see the path forward?
Well, I think we have to think of them as the same fight, right? Racial justice is climate justice. And I think we need to take a good look, hard look at ourselves. You know, those of us who are climate activists, those of us who are environmental and climate activists and organizations that work on climate and environmentalism, you know, we saw what happened at Standing Rock when indigenous protesters were standing up for clean water and the right to, you know, their land and their health. They were brutalized by law enforcement for standing up for clean water. And I think it's really unfortunate that a lot of climate and environmental groups have not focused more of our energies on racist police brutality and on structural racism in all of the different ways that it shows up, because this is work that is not only vital to creating the kind of vision and future, the better world that we wish to seek, but also when we allow racism to continue unchallenged in our own community organizations and circles and spaces, we can't do the work of climate activism and environmental activism, because many vital perspectives are not going to be listened to the way that they need to be and are not going to be respected the way that they need to be. So I see this not as two different fights, but as one central fight. We must be thinking of racial justice as core and critical to the mission of climate justice.
Well, Damon, it's always great to talk to you. I want to thank you for joining us today, and I hope to talk to you again soon.
Thank you so much, Barbara. It was a pleasure to be on today.
Today, we've been talking with Damon Motstory, Healthy Climate Program Director for Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping all of us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us through these difficult times if you're able by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership. You can donate on our website, kboo.fm, by clicking on the donate button in the upper right-hand corner of the homepage. Next week, we'll talk with Heather Price and Elizabeth Burton about the Port of Seattle's plans to expand its cruise ship terminal in the midst of a pandemic. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Thanks for listening. We'll go out with some music by Ali Fakatore and Dumani Diabete. Stay safe, wash your hands, and remember to wear a mask.